Art first. Yeah. Who wants to go first?
You want to go first?
Let's spend 15 minutes each for each idea, and then if we have leftover time, then we can look at other stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. Who wants to start?
Because you're the most senior.
Yeah.
Okay. So, so rather than we're talking about this, how we can make the stripes more reliable.
Okay.
So on the stripes you get different kinds of errors because of media corruptions or writes that didn't actually happen in the right place or didn't happen at all. So how can you ensure that every time you have, you store data on a disk drive, you're going to get it back and you have to leave it.
I can't hear. You have to speak louder a little bit.
Yeah.
Those guys are drowning you. They're so far away.
Yeah.
I can hear what they are saying, but I cannot hear what you are saying.
So, yeah. How to make the drives more reliable?
So,
what are you saying here?
No, I mean, you have already, I mean, RAW is a technique for that, right? But it's encoursing a really huge overhead.
Right, but we want to make it reliable and make it address or handle all kinds of errors, not only NewsDirect with RAW.
But how
so for instance, you can have RAW, you can have checksum, and you can have...
So, but you want to handle recovery or what? Because, for instance, if you have a misdirected write, then you would need to somehow know what was really stored there, right? In order to recover
right.
it. So,
yes.
What do you want to handle?
So
detection or recovery?
Both, actually. So, once you detect an error, then you handle and recover from the error.
Yeah, but how would you recover in that case?
So, well, the idea is that you can have checksums.
Mm-hmm.
You can have ROS, and you also, in addition to this, you also have parity information for the block stored elsewhere, not with the block, not
right.
You know.
And where do you plan to deploy this? I mean, like a file system, like a, I don't know,
yeah,
player thing. Where do you see that?
Well, okay. So some errors are handled by the file system. And the way they handle them are specific to the file system.
Okay.
Yeah, but I guess it would be really related to the file system because you're storing a lot of metadata.
Right.
So Mehta, why don't you present your idea,
mm-hmm.
and then we can ask the questions. How about that?
Oh, okay.
Yeah?
Sorry. I told you, you had just a problem. Not.
Okay, so the problem is this.
Idea.
The
okay.
problem is this.
Okay.
And a possible solution is that you can have for every block, once you write a new block onto the disk, you do a read after write to make sure it's written.
Okay.
Right. Once you write it to the disk, you can have you store it with a checksum.
Okay.
So that way, if it's a misdirected write and you overwrite some other block which you don't want to write, and when you're reading that block, you know that this block was corrupt, right? And you can recover it. And to recover the block, you can store parity information for each block. So if you use your checksum, the misdirected write, and you read a block and you find it's not correct, then you can use this parity information to recover the block again.
That's it.
So that's a basic idea.
Okay. So do you have any ideas as to how you're going to maintain parity and where you're going to put your checksums?
What will you maintain in parity?
What
will you maintain in the parity?
Why?
No, what?
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 Yeah. What? So that I can recover the block again, information so I can return
to so not why, what? He asked what, not why.
Oh, okay.
I mean, will you store like something like XOR or something like that? I mean, but that would be, then you will be incurring you will be using twice the space that is required for each thing.
Yeah, but it's not.
And each time you write, you will need two.
Right,
files.
And you don't have to, exactly, so it's going to affect the performance.
So it would be, for one write, you
right.
will need four IOs.
Right, because you're also going to have to read after the write, and you store
exactly.
parity information.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, it's a huge overhead.
Yeah, so it's a huge performance and space overhead as well.
I'm not sure if that's what
you
said.
No one is going to believe you if you're going to say that. I mean, you have to have belief in yourself that something like this is going to work with acceptable performance. And you have to prove that there is in fact a possibility that you can build a reliable disk with acceptable performance. But if you say that, yeah, we do all these checks and performance is going to suck, no one is going to buy it.
Well, performance will necessarily suck, but it's not going to be what it was, right? It's still going to degrade.
Yeah, but if it's going to degrade by 4x, no one is going to buy it. Or 2x even, no one is going to buy it.
Yeah, but 4x is unacceptable.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
2x may be acceptable, but you have to show that it's going to be in the
but
worst
if you
case,
have to do 2x. All these, if you have to do all these additional IOs, you have to have...
No, that's your idea.
Degradation.
You don't have to. I mean, you could choose to do other things.
What are the things?
You could choose to not updo writes right away. You can choose to buffer some writes, store it in a cache, and so that you can reduce the number of write operations. There is a window of reliability. You can say, okay, at this point in time, if I have a crash and I have corruption at the same in that window, okay, then I will have a corruption on disk. But the probability of having a corruption within a small period of time for a small set of blocks on disk can be reasonably small.
We can delay the...
I'm saying that is one of the possibilities, but if you say
that... No, but
that
even if you delay that, even if you have... You're still adding the additional IOs. So if you, for instance, running a benchmark and you have like four times the IOs, then you have to wait until the entire...
System responsiveness as much as if you do them right away.
Right, of course.
I mean, obviously you will have to do them anyway, but they will not be...
Not necessarily, because there are a whole bunch of overwrites to the same blocks, and you don't need to do all those write operations. If you're overwriting the same block, you can coalesce all the parity updates into one parity update if you delay them long enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you could do those sort of things. But...
And also sequentiality. Mm-hmm. Right, you can improve sequentiality in that.
But the first question is, where do you store checksums?
You
and
store
where
the checksums,
do you store parity?
So I was thinking you store the checksums with the block. So if you have a 4 KB block, then, you know, at the end of it, you would store the checksum. The parity would be in a separate... It won't be co-located with the data.
So where would it be?
In a separate partition in the center of the disk.
No, but, I mean, you will have the same amount of data as you would have for parity. Right, so you cannot say it was the center of the disk. But, I mean, eventually the center of the disk will run out of space.
But you can allocate that space for the entire disk, right?
So you mean half the disk for data?
Or you could have like segments where you have.
That's not parity. That's mirroring. You know, are you saying mirroring or?
Parity? No, I'm saying parity. It's not mirroring. So it's, with parity, it's not 2x times the data. I mean, your data doesn't double.
So I guess the question
parity
is
parity is compressed, right?
How do you compute parity and what do you compute parity over?
Right. So I haven't gotten into those details of how to do the parity, but one possible
checksum and a parity. Checksum is information.
So with checksum you
inside
can
inside the block, right?
With checksum you can detect the error. With parity you can recover from the error because you have information to reconstruct the data.
True. Parity can also detect the error.
Yeah, it's detection and recovery.
So probably, maybe you can do like split it in segments and do parity per segment or something like that.
A parity per segment, and instead of having the partition at the center, after each segment you can store its parity as long as it's not co-located. Because
so how do you store checksums when you don't have space for storing checksums? So you have 512 byte blocks to which you can write. Where do you store checksums?
So the block sizes are 512 or 520, right? So for 520 block size, you have...
Are you referring to the difference between SCSI and serial ATA?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so...
So for if your block size is 520, then I guess it's straightforward, because you can store 512 megabytes, 512 of data, and the rest you can use it for checksum.
Uh-huh.
if you have your, if your block is 512 only, then you can store it at the end of the 4 kilobyte, 4 kb, you know, at the end of 4 kb block.
Okay, so you will have a 4 kb block, then a 512 checksum, then another 4 kb block.
No. So you'll have 7 blocks of data and 1 block of checksum in your 8 blocks.
So that
okay, I get your point.
Yeah.
So that's a space wastage of 1 over 8?
Yes. But I guess you can have like many blocks which have one single, like you can store checksum so many blocks in a single block.
Okay, so it's not.
So we're going to have to do some optimizations to improve the performance.
Yeah, but have you thought about what sort of optimizations you will be doing here? No, you haven't.
Well, one is compressing, or you know. The parity information, we don't know how many blocks we can store the parity information for. So if you can increase that, then we can avoid that space. For the checksum, we need to find out, you know, again, for how many, again, for checksums, you need to find out what would be the size of the checksum for each block.
Let's say a checksum is, I don't know, 16 bytes for a block. Or 4K, 16 bytes. Make some assumptions and go with that. I mean, you don't have to leave everything open.
I could think of a way to store the checksum. So the idea is that you have a... So...
How are we doing on time?
So you have... you divide the disk in a second, right? So this is a second. So you store blocks in here, and you reserve one block where you store the checksum of each of the previous blocks.
So are those 8 blocks or n number of blocks in the segment?
No, I'm saying that you have, I don't know, I have to, you have to do the math, but the thing is that if you have this number of blocks, and each checksum occupies 16 bytes, then you fill one block with this number of checksums. So you will have this same number of blocks here. So if you have n here, maybe you have n checksums.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Right?
So if we have 16 byte checksums, we have
32
block segments.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you have to do indirection because a file system will access this block as a data block.
So the bad thing about that is you need to update that every time that you do a write.
But that's okay because it's not going to be like a very large random.
What? The good thing is that that block, I guess we can assume that comes very close to the other.
Exactly. So you don't have a very large random.
The problem I see there is that both updates won't be a chunk.
Yeah.
That probably could be a problem.
Right, but then both updates don't have to be a chunk.
How do you know that which blocks are going to be checksum blocks and which blocks are going to be data blocks?
No,
the question is, where do you build this sort of a system?
Mm-hmm.
There?
Yeah.
The
who is doing all of this stuff?
Exactly.
Who is making the mapping? Who is creating the checksums?
The block layer.
So the block layer could also do the indirection. So the file system sends a block request to this block number. We know that it's actually offset by one because this block is now used to store checksums. So we need to do a translation from file system issued block number to actual disk block number. So you have a disk which has a whole bunch of blocks,
mm-hmm.
and some of these blocks are checksum blocks.
Right.
So you need to make a translation that maps.
But then you know it's not as straightforward as
like
it sounds.
This.
Because
no, actually, it's quite straightforward.
No, this part,
how many
right, this part
before.
Is fine, but, you know, if the disk thinks that you have n number of blocks, but you're actually using n minus 1, n minus x number of blocks, because you're using x blocks for checksums,
uh-huh.
right? So the disk is thinking its size is so much, but
disk
actual size. I'm sorry. Your file system thinks that your disk size is so much, but your actual disk size is just so much.
Yeah, but.
So what happens if the file system issues request to this part of?
Right, but that's easy. Okay. I mean, the block layer exports is the one that exports that information.
Yeah, but the thing is that
right,
you're
going to have to take
no,
leave
but
with
I,
that.
I guess
mean, it's
point.
Just not
the point is that you're trying to make is that the file system will think that that he can, for instance, he has the whole partition to do its job.
But the file
he actually has less than the
exactly.
whole partition.
Exactly. So we have to somehow yes. So we have to somehow communicate with the file system the.
Yeah, but that's easy, right? I mean, the block layer will export the partition information to the file system. It can put whatever it wants there.
Mm-hmm.
So the file system, when you create the file system, it
right.
will see a file. It will see a disk of much smaller size.
So in addition to this, we also need to do that.
And that's done in the block layer as well.
Right. Yeah.
So it's all of that information. The only thing is that this reliable block device needs to be active when the file system is created,
mm-hmm.
so that the file system has the right size information to work with and create
right.
a file system.
Exactly.
But yeah, so you would have something like this. So where do parity go? I mean, where do we put parity?
I'm thinking, why don't we check some in parity both?
Because you cannot detect data corruption efficiently using parity. Because each time you read a block, you have to read the entire stripe, read the parity to make sure that the data is not corrupted. Checksums give you a fast, efficient way to determine if data is correct.
Right, but when you're writing the data, you have to write the parity and the checksum and the data.
Yes.
So I guess yeah. it could depend on the workload.
Yeah, so...
If it's like a read-intensive workload, then you don't want to... I mean, then you can afford to have checksums, right? Because you would want to optimize for the read. But if it's a write-intensive
yeah.
workload, then...
So even if you have a write-intensive workload, the problem is that when you're reading back data, you need to read the entire stripe, which means all the different blocks that form the parity, not just the block that you're interested in,
mm-hmm.
which may be spread all over the disk.
Mm-hmm.
And you read the parity as well. And then you make sure that the data block is not corrupted. Mm-hmm. Here, the checksum is co-located with the data block. So you read these two pieces of information, and you will know immediately if the data block is corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just confused. So which one is more important, the checksum or the parity? What I am understanding is that if you skip the parity, you can have both, you can detect both the...
You can detect and correct
and recover also.
Without the parity?
What is checksum is providing? What is the extra security you are guaranteed to get with checksum? Checksum is not giving you extra capability from a
reliability
standpoint. It is just making checks more efficient. It will check very quickly whether the block that you read is correct or not, or is it corrupted.
Okay.
If you had to do that using parity, for each time you read a block, you have to read all the related blocks and you have to read the parity and make sure
okay.
that all of these add up to the correct parity value.
It's based on the information on the block itself.
Yes. Yeah. So you create a checksum based on the contents of the block.
But the parity may consist of many blocks.
Yeah. So, but what I would expect from something like this is that first you have to list all the possible classes of errors that can occur and how each of those errors are handled
mm-hmm.
by the reliable disk.
Mm-hmm. So with this, I think it handles most of the errors.
Yeah, but what are the errors? I mean,
latent vector errors.
Uh-huh. You want to write those things down? Oh, by the way, maybe we should come back to this later.
Okay.
Let's stop here. Let's move on to the next one, and we'll come back to this.
Well, make yours before.
But in the meantime, you can make your
list. I guess before going forward, I would like to ask a question. This something like this already exists, or
this?
No, it doesn't exist for single disk. For RAID systems, do have protection mechanisms, but again, that is and file systems do some up to some extent.
Data corruption paper, they already. Talked about those kind of errors and
just the errors.
Just the error, but not how to solve.
Yeah, just the errors.
Well, I guess you can continue.
Yeah, let's continue about this later.
What do you think? It's not about reorganization bearings in a way in which you get data stripe as using stripe as the whole block.
What?
Yeah. You read and write everything in terms of complete stripe.
This is well.
So a stripe is a block.
A stripe is a block.
So
and reorganize data somehow to make reads in terms of block, in terms of stripe.
I don't understand.
I mean, if we read the complete, if we read the complete stripe.
Okay, what's the stripe? You don't know page system?
A page, right?
No, I don't know the names really. You have all your read this and you read this and this and this. You call this a stripe, right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
If you read the complete thing, you don't really need checksums because you have the parity, right?
That's true. Mm-hmm.
So if you organize data in such a way that most of your reads are complete stripes,
mm-hmm.
you have consistency checks.
All your reads need to be like.
Yeah, but of course. Well, most of them.
But it's for a single disk, right?
Yeah, but the thing about doing that is that, if for instance, when you have some errors, latent sector errors, that the media scratch,
mm-hmm.
you lose most of the sectors that are contiguous.
Okay.
Right, so there you would
lose. Spatial locality in corruption.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So also, try to present your ideas in an organized fashion. So so that you provide the right sequence of discussion. So, who wants to go next?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, the project, one project I have in mind is to make a study of file systems in combination with break systems. So,
Okay.
So the idea is to find some values of how the rates behave with different file systems and with different parameters in those file systems. So one of the factors that we can think of is the distribution of the load among all the disks in the rate.
Why do you want to do this?
Because,
I mean, what do you think is?
Yeah, I was thinking that probably one of the things we can give with this is give some kind of rule of thumb in choosing the level of the file system for the rate, some kind of the level that works well with some specific file system.
And what kind of rate?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, because I don't have all the idea completely developed.
How the file system makes an impact on the underlying rate architecture?
Right. So, if you remember the one thing that something I have been thinking a lot of time is that, for instance, if you know that extension 2 has this idea of cylinder group, right? So within each cylinder group, you have a small part that is ion, right? And those cylinder groups are equally separated from each other. So the thing is that if you have that cylinder groups, if the distance between those cylinder groups match the pattern size of the rate, then you will match the pattern size. The pattern size.
What is the pattern size?
Do you remember the deconstructing the rate system? No, the rate system paper.
The size of the chunk. Right, this size. Small size. No.
No, the pattern size is the minimum size you need. The minimum distance you need in order to repeat a disk again in a rate.
Okay.
Right. So the thing is that if that pattern size match the distance between cylinder groups, then you will load one disk.
Okay.
A lot,
right?
And that is not good for the rate. The idea is that you can spread all the loads between all the bits, so you can maximize the bandwidth usage.
I don't understand why the load will not be distributed. Why would the pattern size match the cylinder group size?
Yes.
Okay. And
so then you have all like for EXT2 it. After every cylinder group, it contains the inode data, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the pattern size does not match it, there is a possibility that all the requests for the inodes.
Because all the inodes will map to one disk.
One disk, so you have.
Yes, exactly.
That's a possibility.
So does that mean? So it's not this pattern size matches the cylinder group size. The cylinder group size should be a multiple of the pattern size. Is that what you want to say?
Yes, exactly.
Because pattern size is pretty small. Cylinder groups are much larger.
Yeah. That makes sense. So that's one example. Another example I can think of is if you have a journal file system and you make the journal, you know, probably that doesn't, again, does not correspond to the pattern size, then you won't use all the disks for doing journal. Okay? And that also won't use the whole bandwidth.
But the F2 disk layout is the same as the F2 except for the journal, right?
Right.
I didn't understand the journal.
The journal is the same idea again. So if you have multiple disks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have 5 disks, and you, in the case of write or pass, you have the journal at the beginning of the partition. So if you have something like you have your journal in here, say, right? This would be the ideal case because the journal will send all your disks equally. But if you have something like this, I mean, it's something here. If you have something like this, then you will have some part of the journal in just half of this.
But the journal size and the pattern and the cylinder group are always going to be way bigger than the pattern size, right?
Than the pattern size. I guess that's true, but that's independent of being multiple of the pattern size or not, right?
So if the journal is a multiple of pattern size, it's fine.
Exactly.
In fact, that's exactly what you want.
Exactly.
It's not a multiple of pattern size, then the question is how big is the journal relative to the pattern size? If the journal is much larger to the pattern size, then it's not a problem either.
So what you're saying is that, let's say it's not a multiple of pattern size. It goes like this, and it stops here before using these two. That's what you're saying. So we are wasting this, right? That's
right.
What you're saying.
Right. No, not wasting, not using.
Not using, yes. Because if it went up to you here, you're using everything.
Yeah, exactly.
So
but, right.
But then, I mean, there's nothing to write there. So what do you suppose, I mean, what would be the right way to do it, if not like that?
The right way to do it is, for instance, when you create a file system, you set the size of the journal to be multiple of a pattern size, for instance.
But what if you want only so much journal size, like you have over there? Like, what if... So what you're saying is you should have a journal size of a multiple of this.
Okay.
Right? That's what you're saying.
Uh-huh. Right? Create a file system like that.
Right.
Okay.
But what if, so if I want to have my journal size to be so much for, you know, that is like what I need. I don't need more than that. Even then would I, you know, make so much to be my journal size? Two times?
What do you mean? I
don't think people care much about their journal size.
No, that's
I mean,
exactly.
You say, okay, your journal has to be this or a multiple of this. I don't think.
But you can specify your journal size easily, right?
Right, but this is not only with the journalist. It will also then concern with the data. The journal is just an example, right? I mean, even the way the data is stored would also.
Yeah. I also was thinking about the size of the block.
Exactly.
The file system, how it's laid out in the
right.
RAID.
So if you don't have enough data to write, then how are you going to stripe it across the different RAIDs?
I understand what you mean.
So reduce the stripe size.
Yeah, for instance, that's one option.
You mean the stripe depth?
Size.
The stripe size,
individual chunks.
Stripe unit.
Small, reduce that, and then you can occupy all this.
Exactly, but that's, you know, that's something we don't know.
Yeah, probably some of those constraints will be opposite to each other, right?
I think Lewis's
point with this is that this is like not an idea paper, but rather an analysis paper.
Right, it's an analysis paper.
And then maybe an analysis paper would lead to some guidelines for better file system design for RAIDs, or better configuration of RAID systems, like what should be the stripe size and so on.
Right.
Those sort of things.
Well, there hasn't been a study like this.
I have been looking for previous work, and I didn't find it.
No, I don't think so.
Because I think most of the work is, I mean, it's not at the file system, but tuning the RAID, the stripe size, and all that stuff.
Exactly.
Right?
But the thing is that then you put some file system over that RAID. And then, exactly, so what happened with that? How does that file system use the RAID? So
I think the more interesting question would be, can you choose an optimal RAID parameter configuration, like stripe size, pattern size, RAID level, whatever it is that you can think of, for a given file system, independent of the workload?
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of what workload
okay.
you throw at it, this set of parameters work best for, let's say, Riser. Can we make those claims? Can this sort of a study lead us to some guidelines? Say, okay, this configuration of the RAID works best with the Riser file system. And it doesn't matter what workload you want to talk about.
I'm not sure that you can get to.
I don't know if it's possible or not, but I guess that's the direction you are going towards. So it is possible that in the end, your findings are, well, none of it matters. Everything depends on the workload. And that would be a problem, because it means that you did not get anything reasonable to talk about. And that may not end up being a paper.
Right.
So I think thinking about the workload is as important as thinking about the RAID parameters, the file system design parameters. So you need to, in addition, consider workload.
Okay. I have a question. The idea would be, this would be a theoretical analysis, or more like an experimentation-based because we don't have RAID. Right?
What?
We have RAID.
Yeah. We can make RAID here.
Software RAID.
We can make software RAID.
You mean RAID controllers?
Yeah.
Well, we also have some RAID controllers.
Here?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
No, we don't.
Yeah, but those
machines.
But those machines have RAID controllers. You can do RAID 0 and RAID 1, I think.
It's a straight RAID. You need support from the operating system to run the world. But, well, anyway, I guess
the other thing is, I guess you're so far only thinking about performance. Right.
So
do you want to also think about reliability? Maybe reliability is more interesting, especially from a file system metadata. What if you lose related metadata in one disk or something like that?
Okay.
So in that space, you want to look at what degrade. There is a paper called
degrade.
From Ramsey Group,
okay.
Where they talk about how to spread out related metadata so that you have graceful degradation. If you lose one disk, or if you lose two disks, let's say you don't have any protection and you lose one disk, not all your data is not lost.
Right.
The amount of data that you lose is proportional to the size of the volume that you lost. Size of the disk that you lost, or the proportion of space that you lost because of the failure.
Yeah.
So you want to look at that. Maybe there are some performance-related issues also in that paper.
Okay. So, well, I don't know. I have some questions here, but probably make this more interesting. Do we have more time?
Yeah, go ahead.
So one question that I have was, what journal mode better behaves in RAID system? Having beta or ordered or something else. What is the optimal block size in the file system? If you have a log structure file system, how would the cleaning would do in a raid? What would be a good section size for these lock structures?
So one question: Are you going to evaluate different raid configurations or just?
Yeah, that's also part of the proposal.
So a couple of things that make this study extremely hard, mm-hmm. apart from the large parameter space, is one is file system itself.
Mm-hmm.
How do you populate the file system?
Right.
Where is your data for the file system? That's one. And the second is the workload. What sort of workload are you going to use?
Yeah.
And does the workload require a certain type of file system memory? So I think that...
For the workload, you can use common RAID benchmarks.
Well, you can use the Wisconsin guys approach to the journaling analysis.
Yeah,
they are basically four kind of workloads.
Mm-hmm. But they may.
But those workloads are used to reveal the internal policies. No, they reveal by luck. What they say at the beginning is that some previous work by somebody says that basically there are four types of work, and they use these types. That's it.
So what are these four types of workloads?
Highly random, highly sequential, and based on the characteristics they use.
What paper are you talking about?
Journaling. The one where we...
That paper uses different efforts.
No, but that's what they said. The workload they are using is four because these four are characteristics. Representative of
the general type
of workload.
This one, right? No, this is an evolution
theory.
Yes. So I guess... certainly that paper can give a lot of pointers as to what sort of direction this work can take. But certainly it is more complex than a single disk file system because you have a whole bunch of new parameters to deal with. Yeah. It can end up to be quite a huge project.
Yeah, it's a huge project. Because not only you have file system parameters, RAID parameters, and RAID configurations.
And workload.
So it's workload. So it's four set of parameters that you have to clean.
Yeah, but you can choose the most important ones out of each of these, right? You don't have to do everything. Like you don't have to do like 30 file systems. You can just do the three, four of them. Yeah. And like different kinds of like one journal and one. Huh?
I think that's the kind of work where let's say you build the initial tools and they can be easily divided to a lot of them and work independently. One configuration, something like that. This is what's especially good for dividing work efficiently.
Okay. Yeah, probably so.
Or which is what also for you could work. Do is
And some of the things the paper points about the journal is that when you have multiple disks,
mm-hmm.
you can place your journal on a separate disk, and the rest of the data on another disk. In that way, you can.
So
your performance a lot.
What
so
you're basically doing is...
My thing is that when you are journaling, so why you need to itself, for the journal block, you need to use the striping. Because journaling itself has the mechanism to take care of variety and everything. So why do you need the extra RAID for the journal data?
Journaling takes care of parity. I didn't get that part.
I think what he's saying is RAID systems already have parity, so why have journaling?
No, I'm not talking about.
Journaling is just one file or a partition in the device. Could be a RAID device or a single disk drive. A journal does not have any parity protection or anything of that sort. If you lose data in the journal, it's lost. Unless you protect it by some other means.
Yeah.
That's why you need to have a RAID. If you're using a RAID, you want to have the RAID also address your journaling.
Yeah, in journal, you're only protected from inconsistency, file system inconsistency.
You're not
safeguarded with the data loss.
Yeah, that's right.
So Lewis, what you're basically doing here is exploring the how the right allocation policies for each file system fit onto different RAID, right?
Yeah, I would say that probably.
So
you know, like how they do in the EIO paper.
But
how the model.
Do you guys remember Minerva? Isn't Minerva similar to this? Because Minerva explores different rate configurations and adjusts itself to better fit the workload. Something like that.
Yeah, there is no configuration for file system there.
Well, yeah. in some way you're configuring you're also optimizing for the file system because all the accesses you're seeing are block level accesses.
So Louis, you certainly want to look at that. Minerva, that's a good pointer. Yes, but it is not like an analysis, but more of an optimization.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they point out to some analysis that were done before.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe the references have something in it. Let's talk about the next ID. We can come back to this later.
Sure.
Sajid?
No.
I can go last.
You are okay. Yeah. So I want to discuss about something that I started working on last year, but I couldn't finish it. That's that. For example, the virtualization technology. So right now, the papers I'm seeing from the virtualization technology is basically you leverage the virtualization technology to build something new. Or in a server environment, you use the virtualization technology to create some, to automate some allocation parameters or something. So, but what I was doing on last year is that to evaluate the existing virtualization technology based on how the virtualization technologies perform in disk intensive workload or CPU intensive workload. So that work I couldn't finish it. But what I'm thinking is that, so what about a comparison of different main virtualization technologies right now in
so
the market?
What are some of these technologies you're talking about?
Especially the VMware. Now you have the KVM.
Okay.
Now you have the Microsoft Virtual PC, and then you have the Zen.
Mm-hmm.
So, how these virtualization technologies differ from one another, and what is the performance comparison between those virtualization technologies?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I started last year with using the Zen for the disk intensive workload. We had some results, but we couldn't analyze why the result is like that. So I guess if we can come out with some analysis of the performance, and we can also say that why the performance is better or worse in Zen or in VMware, so that would be a good thing, I guess. Because I have
that's hard to say. I mean, say why.
So this is an analysis paper, and not an idea paper.
No, not a new idea paper, but because right now I was searching internet for those comparison technologies, but mostly those comparisons are done by the companies itself. So Zen does its own comparison, VMware does its own comparison, and you know that they always tend to show that they're
So I guess my question would then be, I mean, this is something that anyone who can set up Zen, set up VMware, and set up whatever it is on their environment, run a workload and report the numbers. Right?
It's not reporting the numbers, but you can also just you can also reveal some details. Technology the Zen or VMware implies by doing those
design
decisions. Exactly.
How would you
know
that?
So if VMware is, for instance, closed source, then you're saying some sort of black box profiling of VMware to reveal their internal design by looking at the performance of the workload?
Yeah.
It's going to be very hard, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a black box, hey, you can have numerous explanations for why you see a certain performance. If it's open source, then maybe you have a much better chance because you can examine the code, you can trace, you can do OProfile and all of those things. Even with open source, with OProfile, it's not easy. When you have a closed source, then I think it's much more difficult, if not impossible, to reveal some of these internal design decisions based on observations on the outside. Is that what you were leaning towards, or are you thinking about something else?
Is this?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to pursue something like that. I mean, if you have a lot of free time and no accountability, then maybe someone can look into it. But I mean, it's important work, certainly. If you can come up with some analysis, then I'm sure some people would be interested in your analysis, but I think having confidence in such analysis is going to be extremely hard. Especially with closed source system. So is, what are the other ones that you mentioned, the KVM?
KVM.
Is that open source?
Yes.
It is open source. And Microsoft, of course, is not open source. So you can, for instance, there is going to be a paper that's going to appear in FAST, which was accepted, which is
on virtualization.
No, it is an it's paper on the analysis of various open source implementations of RAID encoding, RAID coding schemes, or something like that. An analysis of various open source implementations for RAID, various RAID encoding mechanisms. So something like this, which is very small scope, I think is possibly doable. But what you're suggesting is much more expansive, and especially if you're looking at a closed source implementation, it's going to be hard. Maybe if you stick to open source implementations, then there can be something which can be done. But you need like
impact of because right now the only popular technologies are VMware, Virtual PC, and Xen. KVM or VirtualBox, I don't think that's popular.
So
VirtualBox was just part by Sun, so probably it will become more popular.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Yeah.
The problem that I see is that I think this study will end up to be something like, okay, we ran all these workloads, here are all the numbers, and VMware does better for certain types of workloads, Virtual PC does better for something else, and Zen does better for something else. Of course, you also have configuration parameters for each of those virtualization setups. So maybe you can vary those parameters and say for this set of parameters, Zen does much better than for a different set of parameters.
One other important thing is that, for instance, when they deploy those big configurations in the virtualization configurations in data centers, they usually have the application running in one place and the data is distributed over a SAN. Right, so that this is not most of the time it's running in the same place, whereas the application is running.
That's also a good point. And if it's an analysis report, result reporting work, not an analysis, but a result reporting work, I think there, like you said, there are probably lots of open studies that already done by like various forums like Engadget, and I don't know, there are a whole bunch of different forums where they do benchmarking and stuff like that. You might want to look at some of those. I think benchmarking is one way of attracting visitors to your website. So if you have a lot of interesting benchmarking results, you can advertise on your website. So I've seen a lot of websites that,
benchmarking
like business. Any online journalism, right?
And
benchmarking is certainly interesting for a lot of companies, and they are going to choose whether to buy, let's say, Virtual PC or VMware based on what the benchmark numbers tell you. And if you can advertise, it's great. If I have discounted VMware, whatever it is, on that website then. So I think there is a lot of people who spend time doing such benchmarking, because that's the only thing they do. They just do benchmarking and report numbers. And they don't have the obligations to come up with something new. They just report. So we will not, I think we will not be the first ones to do something like that. And I would not be surprised if such benchmark results are already available online. So you might want to check some of them. The real problem is that if you just do result reporting, it's going to be a hard publishing job. People want to see something new and interesting that they can learn from, a new technique, whatever it is that is going to be a takeaway in that finding, rather than just look at benchmarking numbers. If you want to do benchmarking, there are papers which do benchmarking, but they are much more extensive. They look at every possible implementation out there and do much very extensive, detailed benchmarking. And even those papers get published after a very long time. So when they have fixed all the parameters and considered everything under the sun, then the paper would get published. So yeah, I mean, I don't want to seem like discouraging, but to me it seems like something like that is going to be hard to begin with,
and time
and huge amount of time consuming activity with no guaranteed return. And I would also sort of encourage people to think about ideas rather than, I mean, analysis papers are great. So, but I think any of the analysis papers require a lot of work. On the other hand, if you have an idea and you can demonstrate the utility of the idea, you have much easier time with getting it published. Okay, so maybe we should talk about the next idea. Yeah, who wants to talk? Ricardo?
He's waiting.
Yeah, Ricardo was.
Yeah, I don't know what you guys
You say you have two processes, and
one of these processes has, let's say, one process process A, H, one, the other process process L. Let's say process L have a low amount of low L2 cache misses.
Mm-hmm.
Process five.
Means that if you run these processes as from the point of view of the CPU schedule.
So just to clarify, is the percentage cache miss? Or just the absolute value?
Percent, rate.
Rate, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Rate, yeah. So completely different, yeah. If you run process H completely and then process L, the time of execution will be time of H plus time of L. But for example, if you run process...
those are computed running each one independently, right? Or running each
let's
one...
Let's say you know, magically, you know this.
Okay.
Let's say you know
okay.
this information. If you run L and L, L and L concurrently, I mean sequentially, you have a time of L plus time of L. If you put these two, L and L, two instances of the same, same program running at the same time, the time can get almost, can even double. Because these guys, these
wait,
two are
so
both using cache.
What is the difference between first L and L and this L and L?
Let's say these two are running concurrently.
Okay.
Let's say this is like this.
Mm-hmm.
When you put two processes that are highly using the L2 cache and you put them together,
mm-hmm.
the total execution times increase a lot because they are constantly evicting the caches between each other.
You mean that should be H or?
No, L is using the L2 cache because it has high miss.
And
it has low miss.
What replacement policy are you looking
at? I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Just 1 second.
If it has low miss rate.
Low miss rate, so it's using the L2 cache.
It is using
so it's using and then it's extending from the cache.
So
and H is not using the L2.
Edge, it's not. It's trying to use it, but it's not able to use it because it has high administration.
So I guess probably this is.
I see.
Better explaining you have high locality in the L and
That's well. But I wanted to show it in terms of something that we can measure.
Okay.
We cannot measure locality. We can be measured in terms of to cache miss. The thing is that you see that if you have that information at the CPU scheduler level, you could, for example, for process H and L, you can increase the quantum at the cost of a lower responsiveness from the system.
What quantum? The time?
The time quantum of each process.
Okay.
And then you can increase throughput.
Time slice.
The time slice.
So
if you have this information, you can adjust the time slices of some processes.
Okay.
For increased throughput, or for example, you could if you have this.
So, but one thing is that mix rate may not be constant. I mean, it may not be equivalently distributed among process execution.
And
exactly, yeah. But while the process is running, let's say you while the process is running, you can have this information all the time and adjust.
Mm-hmm. An online.
But then you also, so you're just talking about time slices because you also need to know the...
Exactly, that's another thing. Another thing you can consider, for example, if you have these processes,
okay.
L, H, and you put them like this is the worst possible sequence you can have. It would be much better to put, for example, L and, no, let's say, this is way worse, right? Because this cannot be after this will hit his cache. So when this guy comes again, will be very bad.
Uh-huh.
So you see that there is a sequence that is better than others.
And this is for.
Can you elaborate, please? I didn't understand. You see that if you put this after this,
but both are low. Those both have low cache miss rate, right?
Yeah, no, let me think. Maybe I'll give you an example. The thing is that depending on how you place this sequence, you can have better truth. Because...
You mean instructions per cycle? Or
yeah, instructions
CPI.
Per... CPI.
Okay.
For processes that are running at full, at the maximum speed they can, it turns out in execution time.
Okay.
Or throughput in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thing is that now I think with current Intel processors, this is very difficult to do, because having this running all the getting these measurements from the debug from the performance register all the time is very expensive on performance. But there are other new types of processors. There are actually these green IBM processors that provide these performance registers very efficiently, mainly for power prediction and stuff like that. It can be used for things like this.
But they have many more registers, right?
Yeah. They have many more registers, and additionally, in the case of those fancy servers, for example, the PowerPig, you can measure L2 cache misses. And the measurement goes in through a different channel. It has like small processor for doing that, so it won't affect your performance. So I wanna see, for example, in the case of current Intel processors, is this good? Maybe there is some trade-off, right? Or and then try with this PowerPig of the India with the India guys and see what happens and stuff like that. So it's pretty straightforward. Maybe the basic idea is use L2 cache miss rate information for efficient, dynamic IO schedule, CPU schedule. And then, but a broader,
so you want to reorder the
reorder and adjust
processes
and adjust
and miss cache.
Exactly, and also adjust the time slice. And see what you can do, right? But this is the basic idea I have.
I'm still at the basic question. How can the sequence of events impact on the performance?
I have to think of one example. I don't have an example right now. But at least you see that increasing the time slice can, for processes like this, can result in better performance.
I'm not sure of that.
Because you have less context switches for this kind of process. Each context switch costs a lot for processes that are really using them to cache.
Yeah, but the thing is that you're not sure if the next instructions that you're going to run, that process is going to run, are going to be in the L2 cache. That's my concern. How do you predict if in the future you will have the
same? Oh, yeah, well, I won't know. I don't know anything about the future, but I can see trends from the past. Recently, this process has been... Okay, that's another question we should analyze. How dynamic is the L2 cache for given type of workload? If the L2 cache hit ratio is very dynamic for a specific process, you shouldn't mind trying to adjust it because you don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But some processes, you might see some steady trend.
And for those, you can do something.
For those, you can do stuff like that.
Okay.
But for example, you have a process, let's say a web server that is, you will have almost steady L2 cache hit ratio.
The main idea that I see here is that based on the L2 cache miss rate, you change the time cycle, time slice duration.
And maybe reorder the...
The reordering part, I'm not convinced. Because
I'll have to check.
But what you seem to...
Well, I guess I think his argument is that if you have a process which has most of its stuff in the cache already, then it's going to be executed faster. So for those kind of processes, you don't do context switching and waste time in context switching. Right?
No, let's say let's put it more simple. Let's say you only have the processor right now. You only have these two processes.
Mm-hmm.
So for these two processes, you should increase the time slice.
Mm-hmm.
You should, because if you want to increase throughput.
Okay.
Because if you increase the time slices, you will have less context switches, and because each context switch costs a lot, because there are...
Because the L2 cache will be polluted
exactly.
by the other process. So
yeah.
the first process comes back in, it's going to see a polluted L2 cache, it has to reload everything from
there. Exactly, that. Yeah.
And if you do edge-edge with small time slice, it is
doesn't
okay,
matter.
Because
yeah.
edge does not... depend on L2 cache for its performance.
Exactly.
Okay. So I can see how you change the time size. It can probably increase throughput.
This we don't, yeah.
But
I don't
think
of
the sequence. Broadly, you're talking about operating system use of hardware performance counters.
Exactly. That's the broader umbrella.
That's the broader umbrella. So
yeah. This is an example.
But the architecture community has been looking at this for...
Yeah, but this specific case, I don't know.
One group which I'm aware of, which you might want to see, is a group from University of Rochester.
Okay.
And this is Rochester. Michael. I think there is Michael. You forget last
name.
Michael Scott. Yes, thank you. Michael Scott is the guy from.
Michael.
Yeah.
From the office.
What?
From the office.
Is that where you get the last?
No,
that
no,
is
no,
actually
no, 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 because I read.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I remember some Michael Scott from.
Yeah, Michael Scott, and also there's a lady called Sandhya.
I don't remember.
Sandhya. They've basically worked together and they've done a lot of work on use of hardware performance counters for optimizing operating system design. And I don't know if they worked on scheduling and time slice management, but there is a whole community that does this. This is only one group from that community. So I'm not saying that this is not a good idea. It seems reasonable, but you certainly want to look at what these guys have been doing. Okay. Unfortunately, I'm not so connected with this area to okay. immediately tell you whether it's done or not.
I mean, if these guys have been working for some years, I'm sure a problem they have is reading this thing affects performance.
Use of hardware performance.
I think they use mostly simulation.
Okay.
They.
But
yeah. Also, I think Kaishin is the.
And the idea of having these fast, these efficient performance registers in different channels. So I know that is new because that comes with these new IBM processors that are not for sale yet.
So you can profile it without affecting performance.
That's basically.
That's cool.
So that changes everything, I'm sure.
Yeah, certainly, I mean, having a new processor to play with it opens up a lot of possibilities. But you should look at what these guys have been doing to make sure that you're not addressing a problem that people have already looked at and proposed various solutions. If it's a new problem, that's great. I think that makes for an easy paper because you identify a new problem and you propose a solution. If the problem already exists and you propose a new solution, that's also good. But the best case scenario is when you identify the problem itself and no one else has identified the problem and then you propose a solution. Then you can have a much easier time of getting your work published.
Yeah. And the other thing I would like to do, but it's not related to this.
Okay, so then let's wait until later. Let's
wait
for the next cycle. Okay. Yeah.
We can increase your time.
I'm a bit confused. I haven't had much time to think, but I'm just gonna talk about one idea that I thought about some time ago. And it's we know different pulse systems perform under different weight for different file sizes, right? So some file systems are better for small files, some are better for large files, and also the journaling mode of the file system affects the way that performance gap. So one of the things that I was thinking is to come up with this thing called or like a stat that goes above the file system that manages all the metadata of the file, let's not call it a metadata, but this tab that goes above the file, something like this. So we have this, let's call it, I was going to say BFS, but okay, so we have the file system here, so we have...
you can say VBFS.
EXT3 and, I don't know, JFS, whatever, right? And so we have here this, let's call it, I don't know, hybrid file system, hybrid. Okay. So HFS already exists. So HIFS.
Yeah.
HIFS.
Yeah. But hybrid is HY.
HYFS. Right? So this, what this will do is basically, it will demultiplex requests to each file system, depending on which file system is better to service that type of file.
So this seems like one of the papers that we read in the...
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so sorry.
No.
In the review, right?
Yeah, we were... This was one of the papers
that we rejected.
But there they were talking about parallel... There we were talking about parallel environment. have distributed file system, and then for each.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that one. Yeah, yeah.
So this sounds similar to that. I don't know if it's.
But I guess this one applies for local.
This is for local. You're
yeah,
proposing
well,
it for
my proposal
local
for
file
local,
system.
Because I remember that. I think I reviewed that thing, and I do remember that those guys were talking about big or huge storage for scientific computation. So, yeah.
I think we can merge these two projects. When you do an analysis with the RAID and file system, and then find which file system is best for what, and then you can have like a hybrid thing on top of it, and then, I don't know, something like that.
So this, I mean, it's interesting. Let's think about this, because, so you're saying
because
different file systems have different strengths.
Yeah, but not only different file system, because also different journaling modes. For
exactly.
Let's say, for instance, if you're manipulating big files, then probably you will not want to use data ordering, right, for journaling.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're manipulating small files, then it does make sense to use data ordering mode because it will be basically like a log structure,
mm-hmm.
and with let's say relatively small cleaning costs. So in those cases, you may want to either change your change your logging, your journaling parameters, or
the paper
transfer that to
the adaptive journaling. The based on the workload, you change the journaling mode.
That's the one that got rejected as well.
No, that's from
that's from the
no, that's from the active paper.
Yeah. Oh, okay, I see.
So what is the difference?
Yeah, but the adaptive journaling it is depending on the workload.
Yeah, so but that also
so
what are you suggesting?
No, I'm saying depending on the type of file.
Type of file.
Right, so this one will be the file system, and this will be yes to how to lay out the data.
Mm. But how the size of the file will be, how the journaling model will have the effect on the file size?
Not on the file size, on the layout of the file.
What is the performance? You're referring to the performance impact, right?
Can this be extended to availability because different file systems
have
different
errors? Yeah, but that's
NVFS stuff that
yeah.
they talked about while we were there.
Well, you know, NVFS would be one approach.
Mm-hmm.
Because then what they said that they do is that they keep multiple versions of the metadata in different file systems, but they keep only one version of the data.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the detail I remember.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is that you're not going to keep multiple versions of the metadata. You're going to keep one version of the metadata. And the data also on some partition, right? And probably migrate that to a different file system or not file system but layout.
So what you're suggesting is that if you want to access a large file, so you may want to place it either on JSS or based on how the file system handles the file, large or small file.
Yes, exactly.
What about the space management though? I mean, if I have directories that have both large and small files, some files will go to one file system, the other files will go to the other file system, and then
if I lose
the impact of loss of spatial locality.
And what if you have a large file and then you delete content and make it a small file?
Delete?
You mean truncate the
file?
Yeah,
truncate. That's very unusual. Operation actually.
Yeah, normally you are pending, but well, yeah, I don't know. We have to handle that somehow. I mean, I don't have all the answers.
The big problem I have by using multiple file systems is that you distribute space management across different independent entities,
mm-hmm.
so no one has the global view anymore, and it's
so,
going
so
to be
what,
someone has to do the coordination so that you don't mess things up too much,
mm-hmm.
right? Maybe there is at a high level it doesn't sound that interesting. Maybe if you can somehow make provide hints to each file system and tell the file system what it should be doing by having a global view, then it could become more appealing. So each file system does not have a global view. So unless it gets some input from outside, it may be taking wrong decisions.
So what do you tell the file system then?
Maybe you can say, okay, maybe each file system actually maintains the same hierarchy, let's say. And so you have the same hierarchy, all the directories are exactly the same, but individual files are not stored within each file system. So a file will appear only in one hierarchy, in one file system, not in all the... And then somehow, if you can magically still preserve some locality for directories, yeah, I don't know. I mean, so there has to be some hints about how the layout should be done so that locality is not missed.
I think it's better than seeing like for processes that are accessing, for small parts to put in here and for big parts to put in there. I think it's more convenient to see like processes that have workloads of this type go here and processes that have workloads of this other type go there. So all the processes of this type have all the data for this guy and you can kind of increase locality.
You can take me.
So it's not necessary. The workloads may have arbitrary size files.
Can't your layer take care of locality?
How?
I mean, that could handle locality.
If a same process is accessing or creating some files, you can put all files in the same under same file system.
I see.
And if another process is working with another set of files, you can say it can be different.
Oh, that's interesting. So, all the files that a process, a single process actually is going to the same directory.
Yeah. But that would maintain the localization. Right? Mm-hmm.
But how do these files get created in the first place? So when you create your file system and you...
When a process has to create a file image, right?
So you have a starting file system and then you add new executables that create new files. So you're saying that all the files created by a single process will go into the same file system, maybe in the same directory. So the applications have no control on the namespace. Applications don't see the namespace. They see some namespace.
Yeah.
They see some namespace.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily what
it's really. So that namespace gets mapped to something else.
For example, the postmark will create a set of small files. So the same postmark thread is creating all those files. So you can say that JFS is better for small files. So you take JFS and put all the files there.
Interesting, yeah. So if you take a process-centric view, then it seems to make more sense. Yeah.
And also the journaling mode comes into the picture in that case, because when you have random operations, you would probably like to use the data mode of journal, because that will make all your randomness into a sequential one.
Depends on whether you're doing large IOs or small IOs.
Yeah. But it's from experimentation, it's clear the random IO is supposed to be better for in data journaling mode. And sequential
and the more journaling mode is specific to the file system. So you can can you have a single file system support data as well as ordered
files?
But
not
at
the same time.
Multiple instances
at the same time.
Not at the same time.
Okay, so
you
can have multiple instances.
Yeah.
You need to all mount it and unmount it again.
Interesting, yeah. Sounding more and more interesting. The question is how do we evaluate something like this? So if you have a monolithic file system, a single file system that addresses all the workloads, then we would have to say, okay, here is how, if you just use EXT3, this is how it looks. If you just use JFS with the performance and then you say, okay, here's how the hybrid would
mm-hmm.
perform. But you're running a lot more software now. So which means you can trigger a lot more bugs than if you just used a single file system.
Yes, that's true.
But seems interesting. Seems worth discussing more at least.
And I'm thinking that probably you can also use this to improve not only performance but something else like reliability. So somehow you mark some files that's very important and you can store those files in some
yes, and during the file system, you could know which files are very important. For instance, let's say bar user. We can
exactly.
User bin is very important.
Right.
Or bar bin or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds interesting. It would be workload centric rather than file size.
Workload centric, yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah,
that makes more sense. What do we workload centric?
File size is difficult.
Yeah.
It would be very difficult to.
Yeah, because it bears.
The same process may use large
different
files, small difficult. Files, and then localities and stuff.
But you can have different processes using the same file.
You could, yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's true. That is true. So the process that creates the file gets...
So in that case, you could also probably even provide multiple copies of the file to increase both performance and reliability, right?
Mm.
Sorry.
Seems like an interesting idea to pursue. Let's certainly discuss this further. Okay, so anything else, George, you wanted to add to that? Or
No, that's basically it. Yeah, it was very preliminary.
Okay, so what do you want to do next? Should we continue our discussion? Or stop. I mean, we want to do this once in a month, right? First Tuesday or second Tuesday, something. What did we decide in the end?
Second
Tuesday of each month.
So probably if someone has another idea, probably it's also good to take it into account, I guess. I, instead of going to, probably better to go into press than into that.
Okay, let's talk about more ideas then. If there are more ideas,
probably we should focus more on this self-resistance interest.
No, I mean, but...
That's what he's... So you're saying go into depth, he's saying go into breadth.
Yeah. Oh, they're going to get it.
So, yeah, I agree that this certainly has some merits. Of the ideas that I've heard today, I think I'm biased towards the reliable disk because that's what I've been thinking about for a long time. And also, I sort of like where this is going, but I don't know. I mean, so far I've not thought about this well enough to determine whether whether I think it has potential or not, but certainly worth discussing more.
Probably we should just look on the paper that Luis reviewed. It's something similar.
Which one?
The
distributed file system. Okay, yeah, sure. We should do that. But from what I understand, that paper was very light. It didn't really propose anything. It just said, okay, here's a layer that ties in different types of file systems. But didn't suggest any mapping of work of specific data to specific file systems.
No, I think the problem with that paper was that they said...
That didn't get in, right?
No.
They said that... The system magically maps some files to some file system and some more files to some file system. But they didn't say how that
Yeah, that was the problem with
the
paper. So I couldn't really get anything out of the paper.
Yeah.
Except this general idea that, yeah, why not use more than one file system to store data?
Mm-hmm.
So add another layer of virtualization. Okay, so are there other ideas that we want to talk about beyond the ones that we've explored already?
I could discuss one more.
Okay.
Oh, actually, this was somewhat your idea because we started in a brainstorming session, and I guess I will present it on your behalf.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
So the thing is that I have seen a lot of papers talking about these huge storage farms, right? Where you have very different storage nodes, and you want to migrate data from one node to another to achieve something. Could be performance, could be reliability, could be power saving, all of stuff.
But it's permanent migration or temporal migration?
Could be temporal migration.
Okay.
Okay. So here what is proposed is to build a general architecture to do this. Right? So the idea is to have for each node have some kind of OPT partition, according to the Borg terminology. And this OPT partition could be used to store this data from other nodes and achieve the goal they want to have. And looking all these nodes, you will have a controller which will see the workload that you have, right? And in that controller is where the decisions will be made about where to migrate the data from and to, right? So that's more or less the idea. So
let me see if I got it. So you have this large amount of storage nodes, and then you have like this manager for those storage nodes that decides where to migrate that data.
Right.
Okay.
And of course, that controller is particular for each. It's a very specialized controller for each, storage farm, because it depends on how.
It would be a good idea to look at a real example of an optimization, and put this whole architecture in context. For instance, if you look at workout.
Right.
So, which is basically reliability improving optimization for RAID systems. They talk about this building workout for a high-end storage box, which has a supercontroller, which manages a whole bunch of different RAID systems internally. Now, the supercontroller is a centralized entity. And if you have a high-end storage system like the ones that EMC or NetApp built, then you could have that sort of internal highly connected architecture. But in general, you have something which is more loosely coupled, and you have storage area network, individual storage nodes, which may not be so fancy, maybe individual RAID systems, or even individual disk drives that are all connected over some sort of network. Mm-hmm. And then how do you make something like workout map onto this architecture? So what sort of mechanisms and entities that need to exist for workout to be realized in a SAN-like environment rather than a high-end storage box? So I think if you start putting things in context, then you can make your ideas more concrete. What exactly is the role of the central controller? What is the role of the individual storage nodes? What sort of protocols are required? What sort of management issues need to be dealt with? For instance, space. those sort of things, I think will have more context if you take a real example and work with that.
Okay. And try to map it.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not clear to me, how will the controller decide which one is better? Where to migrate?
So the controller needs to have some information to make such decisions. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, individual nodes need to feed information to the controller. About, for instance, they can feed information about load.
So let's say you want to migrate it to a place where such that latency is reduced, something like that. I mean, would you be able to make that decision?
If the controller has the information to make that decision. The point is that an optimization already exists. Okay, so you build some optimization, in this
mm-hmm.
case, let's say latency-based data reorganization.
Mm-hmm.
How do you map it into a SAN-like environment? So for instance, if we want to let's say do something like workout, map it to a SAN-like environment, the mechanisms are already in place, but it's not built for a distributed architecture. So how would you build that? And I guess when I was talking about this, this idea is more in context of block-level optimizations.
Right.
So if you have block-level optimizations where you want various block level instances of these optimizations spread across a network to communicate, to do something better than each individual instance can do, then you need some sort of central control that will aggregate information and do resource management decisions. I mean, I don't see it as some great idea by itself. It's just a mechanism to take existing optimizations that are built for, let's say, a specialized environment to map it to a more network-based storage environment.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no paper here, but rather just an idea that can help an existing idea in an existing piece of work to enhance the scope of that work. Okay, anything read first?
There is something more. I don't have any idea related to this, but maybe somebody has an intuition about what can be used. Remember, we were talking about, told me about the idea of approximate content,
uh-huh.
approximate similarity between content. So, Professor Raj was telling me, it turns out that most of the writes, in average, most of the writes that are done are just have only very, very, very small modifications to previous blocks. So, how to use that? That's the question.
So previous blocks, you mean that it's like you read a page, you modify two bytes and write it again.
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
That's the average general write that you do.
So, what was your point?
I mean, you know that,
okay.
Right? So, how can you use it?
It's a problem space, I guess, rather than a specific problem.
Yeah. How can you use it for doing smart?
Can you use that for improving performance, for improving power?
Yeah.
For improving.
So why don't you keep a log of the differences?
Yeah, the byte difference.
Yeah.
There are already journals based on differences.
And instead of writing large chunks of data to disk, you can write small changes to flash or something like that.
But that's already working.
It's done?
I don't know. I think because on the journal you mentioned.
Yeah, but I'm saying that for power consumption, for power savings, if you, instead of writing large amount of data to disk, you write these log of these small changes to flash.
Why we? Yeah, so it's like Excel, basically.
If you have space limitation with
mm-hmm.
excess, this can be the
solution. Right. You're setting the differences
like
in excess, for instance.
But the problem is that this it's going to be invasive because it's very hard to detect changes by application. Right.
And to detect changes, you will have to go
detect
to the
detect changes by application.
Actually, you can because
yeah,
it's a write. If it's a write,
you can
unless it's a memory map.
Oh,
if it's a memory map,
think,
then it's a problem.
Yes,
but if it's a write call, then you can possibly detect changes.
And you also need to account for the, for instance, for the power consumption, the power required in detecting the changes.
That's true. Good point. But it's not just about power. I mean, you could use this knowledge for
speed
doing
problem.
Different things.
No, but mainly performance, I guess.
Space
well,
yeah.
It could also,
reduction.
It could also
space
do power
reduction.
Yeah, space reduction. Yeah, those sort of. And versioning, when you do versioning, you can.
Versioning, yeah.
You can use that information.
Okay, I was thinking about it.
Yeah, probably those guys that do versioning, because there are many approaches to block versioning.
Block versioning.
Sometimes you
have an idea about related versioning.
Related to version.
Describe you describe it in very detail. Or something like I don't know.
It was in the it says recorder or not?
No, it wasn't.
It was before we started recording.
Or,
yeah. See, it would have been nice to record it.
Yeah.
What did I say? Okay, yeah. If it's important, then I would remember. It's probably not important. But yeah, I mean, for instance, there are other problem domains where you can think of, let's say, using Flash for doing various things, right? So using SSDs to build hybrid storage systems. People have been thinking about doing things like that. So if you want to build a RAID, but also use an SSD, how would you use SSD to improve performance, reliability, whatever it is that. Can I use an SSD to build a reliable block device? A single disk, have some flash in embedded, and I use that to make disk more reliable. Those sort of things you can. Now that's another problem space. Because you have SSDs now, and the space is wide open, there are lots of interesting things that can be done.
Yeah. I have one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
For the reliable storage, we could use Flash to store the packages or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
For the reliable storage, we could use Flash to store. So we avoid the extra
Yeah. Makes sense.
How are you?
Yeah, if you have your privacy, you could have it in a flash in your
so what reliability
is
flash
file.
More reliable
yeah,
than
exactly.
Disk?
The reliability is not a single dimension. There are various dimensions to reliability. For instance, the fidelity of the medium is one dimension. So if you write a bit, how long will it survive? How many times can you write a bit? How long will the component itself survive? If it's mechanical, then you have various mechanical components. What is the longevity of those? So I think it's very hard to evaluate reliability using a single metric. So different devices are more reliable or less reliable across different dimensions. So for instance, with Flash, you can only write a constant number, overwrite for a fixed number of times.
Mm-hmm.
But it would probably survive longer if you just not use it. Disk drives will break after a certain period of time. I think it's hard to say that disk drives are more reliable than
Flash
or vice versa.
But the main usefulness of SSD is their power consumption criteria, right?
Also, no, performance. I mean, everyone is also power consumption, certainly. But performance is what everyone is excited about because you have very good random access performance.
Random reads.
Yeah, random. Yeah, that's right. Random reads. Random writes are a different story.
But the SSD crash is going away.
I don't think so. No, there were about 15 to 20 papers in FAST this year on SSDs.
Yeah.
None of them made it, actually.
None of them.
A good way to do
it. So people
really,
are
like, none of them, no flash papers?
None of the papers are good enough, unfortunately.
Wow.
People are. I mean, there was a discussion at the PC meeting, what sort of panel should we have? And there was one of the suggestions which was very well received was a panel on disk drives versus SSD. And the future of disk drives and the future of SSDs. So have two people from the disk drive community and two people from the SSD community and have them and have a panel.
And then it's fun.
Yeah.
So everyone, you end up with a hybrid data.
Yeah. Some guys say, I take both.
Yeah,
so they're going to have that panel?
I don't know. It's one of the suggestions. On the
yeah, the there's no program posted yet.
No. It's too early. Yeah. So yeah, what do you want to do next? Are we done for today then? Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. Well, this is not really a paper by itself.
Uh-huh.
This is more like investment.
Uh-huh.
In learning for the future.
Uh-huh.
How do you manage?
I discovered what happens is because of this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So take away that from
okay.
Sorry.
Okay, you know that on ESX there is this indirection of pages so you don't have duplicated
mm-hmm.
pages in memory. On Zen there is no such thing. So it will be a nice experience. It will be a nice slash pain experience to implement that in Zen. Yeah, we could learn a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, the conservation of memory is that the same page that you're talking about?
I mean, the same content can be pointed but different
mm-hmm.
pages.
That happens
the same frame,
that happens
but different frame.
Yeah,
that happens in ESX, but in Zen there is a
thing. But in Zen, you have the problem that everything goes to the main zero, so you will incur an additional overhead because you allow multiple domains to go to the same
but
page.
But actually, not everything goes to domain zero.
No. Yeah, but if you allow multiple pages to be owned by different processes,
different virtual machines,
then you will have to... I don't know how that communication will be. I mean, you will have to...
I don't know. I have to think from the beginning. Just fine.
Yeah, but what you need to keep in mind is that something might be interesting and a learning experience, but if we end up spending a lot of time on it and not have any research outcome, then it's not a good idea because then the problem is that we do not have that much resources to do exploratory stuff. I mean, this is not even exploratory. If it were exploratory, it's probably okay, even if it's sort of an open-ended thing, but it can lead to something which is research, then it's okay. But here it's just reproduction of a capability that already
yeah.
exists
yeah.
in a different environment.
Yeah.
It's hard to justify that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
I imagine that.
Yeah. It would be a great learning experience, I'm sure it would be. If you take any big piece of software and you start playing with it, it will be a great learning experience. And you will learn even as you do stuff with the research projects that you're doing, right? You always end up learning something about... For instance, you'll end up learning something about how IOs are done in Linux or something about how file systems do allocation, things of that kind. But at the same time, you get to make some research contribution.
So I also have, well, it's more an open question than an idea. I was thinking that currently the only... let's say, established fault tolerance mechanism in disk is RAID, right? So if you want to provide fault tolerance, you just have to provide redundancy, right? So, and we have been stuck on that idea since, I don't know, 30 years ago, right? So probably it's because it's the only way to go, but I don't think so, but or just that it was so good and so simple that we just said, okay, let's just take this as the rule and not explore anything else. So my open question was, is what else can we do to make a bunch of this reliable?
To provide fault tolerance for
the disk.
Yeah, I was thinking of that actually for this project, but it's really hard to do that because you need to have redundancy in some form. It's not actual mirroring of the data. You need to have parity information or something where you can retrieve the data back.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an open question. I mean, probably,
So
maybe redundancy, but maybe something which is different than a RAID-like parity-based redundancy, maybe some other form of redundancy, I don't know. Maybe you make redundancy inside each drive rather than across drives, something like that, I don't know. Or come up with a new RAID level. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about, exactly, exploring more options besides what traditional RAID provides. Because we have been stuck on that for a whole bunch of time.
But people have been sort of extending RAID with RAID 6 and RAID DP and so on.
Yeah, but everything is based on the same idea that you stripe data across. And, I mean, why not come up with something different? And maybe...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just an open question.
No, it's worth asking that question. I don't have any problems with that. Yeah, if you can come up with something there, even if it is not as good as RAID, if it's something valuable to learn from, I think that could be interesting. A different sort of coding technique or...
Yeah, so probably this has something to do with the... reliable bit.
Yeah, I was thinking about this.
So what you were saying is that the only way to provide, I mean, one of the, let's call it the most efficient way is with redundancy.
Yeah. And generally, you know, the more redundancy you have, the more reliable your storage is. Idea.
So I guess the point is that for a single, building a single reliable disk, you cannot build something that's bulletproof, right? If the arm fails, the disk is gone.
No, but
or if your head crashes,
then
the disk is gone. So you cannot have...
We are not talking about disk, you know, crashes or...
Yeah, so I guess...
Earthquakes or hurricanes or anything like that. We're just talking about data corruption, but the disk is still...
No, we don't need to have earthquake or hurricane
for
a head to crash.
In the disk reliable, in the reliable disk storage, what you're trying to address is errors that occur and corrupt some part of the data, not the entire data.
That's a silent data problem.
So this is like what we are talking about, instead of fail stop, instead of the disk just dying instantaneously,
right.
We have some sort of Byzantine faults,
right.
Where the disk responds in ways that it should not be responding if it were operating correctly. So we are talking about making Byzantine disks into fail stop disks and providing reliability at that level.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's worthwhile because now at least I'm guaranteed that if my disk tells me something, it's going to be.
But
right.
You don't know if we have a flash and if we store.
Yeah, but not only that, but you have the guarantee that.
Hold on. If we have a flash and if we have a disk and if we store parity for each block, then even if the disk fails, we should be able to construct the data from the flash, right?
What? With the using parity alone?
Yeah, but we have to store more parity information, of course. But
no, you cannot use just parity to reconstruct data. You need to have all but one data and parity to reconstruct one missing data item.
Yeah, but that will be mirroring
what I was saying.
So never mind.
Yes, George, your turn now.
I don't know. Yeah, we're not. You have to record it.
But I've been thinking about the reliability for some time, but I think that we can do something very interesting with that problem.
I think we can optimize a lot of.
The first thing to do is to list, make a list of comprehensive set of errors, and make sure that any design that you come up with has to be detailed and addresses all of those types of errors.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing to do would be to create a design that is conducive to performance optimization.
Yeah, my only concern is that the overhead will grow a
no,
lot.
But, you know, we don't have to. Yeah, but we could somehow optimize that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but it would still be big. Because if you maintain parity, then you will have to either do incremental parity checks or and that would incur an additional read for each write.
So the point is that you do not want to.
No, you would just use the checksum for the read, not the parity for the read, for the write.
But you still have to calculate parity somehow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So if you store parity, you have to calculate.
Yeah, but you write it in block. Okay, yeah, but never mind. It depends on how we store the parity.
You're talking with yourself, Leila. You don't know what's
no,
going
no.
on.
Discussion.
Internal discussion. So yeah, I guess I certainly like the idea of putting. So what I was thinking is that if this disk, right, you split it up into various groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make, in this case, one of these a parity group. So here my parity would be over all the data blocks at the same offset within the various groups. So I have, so the size of each group, of course, has to be the same and should be equal to the size of the parity group as well. So I compute parity and block-wise parity across all of these.
Well, you know, what I was thinking is instead of that, I mean, that this was before I thought of using the flash for parity. But you can have some, like, for instance, instead of doing this, because if you have to calculate, I mean, if you think you find the parity for these blocks and then store it on this parity,
mm-hmm.
like, section. So instead of doing that, we could use the parity for a set of blocks here, consecutive blocks.
For a segment.
For some segment.
Uh-huh.
And then store it
within the checksum.
Assign it sequentially on a different
so
stack.
If you lose the entire thing with a I think that the layout will depend on which guarantees you want to provide.
No, the point is that you want to make the parity elements as independent as possible. There is work that shows that data corruption has spatial locality.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to take out all these data blocks, you cannot reconstruct any of them.
Right,
parties.
But then maybe we could use any sequential blocks and the parity.
Yeah, you could do some staggered striping stuff.
Yeah.
But the point is that the data items over which you're calculating parity have to be spatially uncorrelated.
Right, yes.
So that you
right.
do not lose two of them at the same time. Then you have to handle double book failure
right.
kind of stuff.
Right. So if you have different tracks like this, and you could calculate the parity for this portion of the parity. So if you have to reconstruct the parity, then you don't have to. Then you would save on the rotational matching.
So these are next tracks? Is the next track to this? Or in the next group?
Next n number of tracks.
Well, the problem is that you need to know all the semi-sequential information, which is just impractical, we know that.
Oh, yeah.
You cannot do those kind of things. But you can take some other offset and put it there if you want to do some staggered typing. But the simplest thing is to just pick all the blocks at the same offset and compute parity over those blocks.
Mm.
So the point is, how do you handle reads? So with reads, you read the block, check. Match it with the checksum, see if it matches. If it does, great, the read is fine, and you're done. If it doesn't match, then your data block is corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Then you need to go and retrieve all the other guys,
mm-hmm.
reconstruct the data block, write it back, and respond to the application that the IO is coming. So if you have a corrupt data block, then you incur the overhead of reading all data items that form that parity.
Which is fine.
Because you won't have corruption that often.
Exactly.
For a write operation, it's more tricky because if you update a block, there are two ways to update parity, additive and subtractive, right? And it seems like it would make more sense to do either one based on the contents of the cache, what you have in cache. So if you have all the other blocks that you need to use to compute the new parity, then you do additive parity. If you don't, let's say you have the previous version of the data that you, of the block that you overwrote, then first of all, what you can do is you can always keep a copy of the previous version of the block that, if at all possible, before overwriting it, so that you can compute a subtractive parity over that block. So
in the cache.
In the cache.
Okay.
So if you write a block, keep a copy of the block separately in a different cache until the point that it either gets written to or a timeout expires. So if it gets written to, then I have the previous version of the block, I have the new version of the block, I can compute subtractive parity and directly update parity without having to read the parity.
But how would you know which blocks to keep longer in cache?
What?
So you keep all blocks?
Not all blocks. So blocks that are either written or a timeout expires. So you can maintain some sort of timeout mechanism. The other thing that you could possibly do is do parity updates in idle time. So you compute the parity but don't write it. So you store it in memory. And then when you have idle time, you write out parity. So you could sort of trade off reliability, instantaneous reliability with performance time.
Mm-hmm.
And the response time performance. So you can do some of these interesting things. And if you're targeting a reliable disk for home use, where I/O is not necessarily the bottleneck, or at least not continuously.
For archival storage, this would be a good solution, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you do it for archival storage, yeah, maybe. But if you do backups, then your backups have to be somehow.
But you wouldn't do archival storage on a single disk. Right? Generally.
Eventually, your data has to go to some disk. It's or a tape. And if you're using tapes, then this doesn't work. But if you're using, actually, even for tapes, this may work, but we don't want to talk about it. but if you're archiving on a disk, then
but you would usually use RAID.
If you use RAID, then this probably does not make much sense.
Right. So you don't usually use archive data on single disk, right?
Yeah, but when I thought about this originally, my intended domain was just home usage. Single desktop machines, you know, even...
Right.
Even work.
Standalone
disks which contain data which is important. Well, how do you protect it?
Yes, for instance, what you use in research applications, like computation.
And in those sort of environments, you have a lot of idle time. And you don't.
Yeah.
IO performance may not necessarily be a problem. And there are.
Bring up 90% idle time.
Maybe. And if you can delay it long enough, you will eventually find some idle time period where you can do your parity writes or you do whatever it is that you need to do. The write operations that... The other thing that you can do is, instead of sending the write to disk, you have like some other non-volatile cache, like a SSD or something, or some flash embedded within the disk where you can buffer all the writes. And then you can do parity computations and all of that in the background. Right? So these are some of the things that you can do.
Or you could just write the data with the checksum and put the parity on the...
Yeah, I mean, for instance, you could put this in a USB or something.
Yeah.
You know, store all the writes to USB and then write it to this.
Maybe not the writes, the parity.
I'm talking about the writes itself. So when you start doing writes, if you do the write, if you send the data to disk, you need to somehow keep persistent information that this block was updated. So you can, later on, if you have a crash, you can make sure that parities are updated. So otherwise, you don't know whether your data is out of date or your data is is corrupted or your parity is out of date. So those sort of questions will remain.
Right, but I was thinking that you would have to do a parity check periodically because the parities could get corrupted, you know, even with...
Yeah, parities have their own checksums. So when I read my parity, I will know if the parity is correct
or not.
Yeah,
but if you have, like in the parity section, if you have a latent sector error, for instance, there will be no checksum too.
Yeah, I guess there would.
Yeah,
be,
if
right?
there is no checksum, I know that the data, the block is corrupt. The checksum is missing or it's a wrong checksum, doesn't match with the block, it's all the same thing. The block is corrupted, so the parity block is corrupted. I have to reconstruct parity from my data block.
Right, but you don't know this until you read it.
That is true, yes.
So that's what I'm saying. You would have to periodically, in addition to this,
data,
you know,
scrubbing?
Data scrubbing in RAID, you would have to do something like that for the parity information.
Why just the parity? I mean, you can scrub the entire disk because data cannot...
You don't have to because...
There is no distinction between data block and parity block here. They're all at the same level.
Right,
because
right.
you lose one, you can get the other. You lose this one, you can get the other. So there is no...
But it would be faster to scrub the parity than the data. So that's the parity.
Or scrub one cylinder group of the data.
Yeah, you don't have to scrub the whole disk. That may take a long time.
Yeah,
I think
saying,
scrubbing
just
is something which
scrub
is...
With whatever parity
I
you
see
have
your point. I mean,
the disk may not, you know, be completely occupied as well. So just scrub whatever parity you have instead of, you know, moving.
The point I'm trying to make is that the parity is nothing special. That you should focus your scrubbing on the parity. There is...
Very good.
If you just scrub any of the data groups, it's the same effect as scrubbing parity.
Sure, yeah, but like for so much of data, you have only so much of parity information. So which one would you scrub? Which
I'm
one
saying
longer?
That you can scrub only one group to achieve the same effect of scrubbing parity.
But you want to scrub all your data.
Well, then scrub the entire disk. If you want to do scrubbing, you should be doing full disk scrubbing, but that takes a really, really long time.
That's what I'm saying. It would be good enough to just scrub the parity.
Or any of the groups, individual groups of data. Because there is no, parity is nothing special, is what I'm saying.
So we are going to read the actual data, not the parity. And this data can be constructed from the parity if it has errors.
If parity has errors, I can reconstruct parity with the data.
Right. And if the data has errors, we can construct from the parity.
Yes. So parity is nothing special.
So why do you have to scrub the parity and the data? I mean, you can just scrub one of them.
I know. I'm saying that you can scrub one of the data groups instead of the parity. The point I'm trying to make is that what is the justification of scrubbing parity alone? I don't see the justification of scrubbing parity alone.
Well, because, okay, so my point is that if you have some data stored in a disk and you scrub it and you find some error and then you reconstruct that data, that is fine. But why do you want to reconstruct data when you don't need it? So you can just reconstruct data when you need it because you know that your parity is definitely going to be good.
I see. So yeah, that makes sense. Yep. Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive because there is really no distinction between any of the data groups and the parity group.
Yeah, sure, but you don't want to construct data which you probably never need, as long as you're sure that your parity is correct. Maybe once in a while you would want to scrub your data, but I think most parities would be more frequent that should be scrubbed.
So I guess your point is that I would update parity more often. Then I would update data blocks. I would read parity more often than I would read data blocks. Therefore, the reliability of the parity information is of greater value than the reliability of any individual data block.
Right.
Maybe. Yeah. But I think, what you're saying does make sense. But you will have to avoid having to deal with something like failures of two data blocks at the same offset. You will have to scrub data partitions to have at most reliability. But you can do that once in a while, once in a month.
And you can do it
like
with groups instead of doing the whole disk at a time.
Right. Okay, yeah. So that's one thing. And the other thing that is, if you do any sort of buffering and delaying of operations, you have to store some information persistently that these are the outstanding operations.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that you could do is to say, is to maintain a bitmap in the parity group saying all these parities are currently inconsistent and they need to be reconstructed at a later time.
So if you're maintaining...
So the up-to-date is sort of an up-to-date bitmap of all the parity information.
And how do you identify whether the parity is not updated?
Because you have delayed it. So
you're saying that you write a piece of data, then you write this information to the parity as well, that this parity is not calculated. Then you calculate the parity and then you rewrite the parity. And then say this parity is now reliable.
You need to have some persistent information that tells you that a parity block is out of date.
Right, but instead I would like if you use the SSD for that information, like you said.
Yeah, certainly you can use an SSD, but that's an additional cost. I mean, not everyone would buy that. We could propose something like that, but then you have an additional device to deal with. I would say that talk about a reliable disk and then have the SSD version as an option. Say, okay, instead of having it here, if you had an SSD, this is what you would get. Because if your disk is, I don't know, what are the usual storage capacities of this type these days? 250 gigabytes?
No, I guess 250.
500. Now, what is sort of the
biggest one?
Average.
250. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think laptops usually come with 250 to 320 gigabyte drive.
Let's
so desktops should be bigger. I guess 500.
Okay, let's say 300. Okay, so 300 is a round number. So if I have a 300 gigabyte drive, the first question I have is, there is a trade-off between the amount of parity space that you use, okay, and the amount of overheads that you will incur in maintaining that parity. So if you have a large parity block, then you have fewer number of blocks over which you can compute parity. So if I have, let's say I have a 300 gigabyte drive, and let's say I have a 100 gigabyte parity area, then I have a RAID 5 like configuration with three drives.
Right.
So I have 100 and then 100 parity and 100
gigabyte.
Right.
Wait, so you're okay.
So my parity is 100 gigabytes per.
Okay.
So to update parity, I need to read only two.
Right.
But I have all the space wastage or large amount of space required for parity. If I had, instead of 100, if I had 30 for parity, then I have 10 such groups.
Right.
So to update parity using additive parity, I have to read 10 blocks to compute that parity. So there is a trade-off here as well.
But in that case, you're also losing... There's also trade-off in the reliability that you have.
No.
Because when you have more parity, you also, it's more reliable, right?
If you have more parity, it's more reliable, that's true.
So...
Okay.
But here, you can lose...
Yeah, the most reliable will be mirroring.
Actually, you can lose all of this entire area and still be able to reconstruct everything.
Yeah.
In this, you can lose only one area. Which is
you can
30
do
sensitivity
analysis with this
structure. So, but my point is that you need to have some persistent information that will tell you which parity blocks are up to date and which are not, so that you have to do it later. So, what do you think about this?
I think it's a very promising interesting.
I think if we go through the list of all the errors and make sure that we address all of them, like don't write, misdirected writes, latent sector errors, data corruption, all kinds of different problems, can we address all of them? So we convert disk entirely to a fail stop failure mode, then it's something interesting. Then there is also a huge space where we trade off performance with reliability, and how much performance hit we can we need to take.
Yeah. I think we should go through the parity, lost parity regain paper, because they have all the errors and what would be the best way to handle each error.
Sure.
Maybe that would help.
And the other is there a different way to organize the parity part?
Right, yeah.
Can I spread it out in some way?
Right, so I think for like a number of tracks you can have some parity, and then again you have some tracks, and then it's parity, it's restoring all the parity together. So we can make groups.
I think for that you can take advantage of the pre-block scaling, right? So you can have something like a parity, the data block, and then the parity somewhere where it's not that far in terms of rotational and seek, right? In a different track, but in terms of that when it rotates, I mean, it's hard to calculate that, but...
Well,
depending on predictability of rotational delay, I think it's not a good idea.
So you have these data blocks. Right, and then we'll have a parity information for these data.
Uh-huh.
So we could have something like this. So the parity information for these data blocks is here.
Uh-huh.
For at the middle of these tracks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then you have more tracks in here.
Uh-huh.
So this entire track would have parity information.
Okay.
Right, for these four data blocks.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Depends on the spatial location.
But that's hard to. So allocate it like that.
No, we don't have to deal with tracks at all. It doesn't matter whether it's in a track or not a track. It doesn't matter. It's just in a linear address space. You're saying instead of having parity for all groups, you split the disk into chunks.
Exactly.
And then within each chunk, you do exactly what we are trying to do here.
Yes.
So if I do an update, then the parity is bound to be within a range.
Yes, so you don't have to do that.
Yeah, sure.
And it is much safer if you have parity.
You have to be careful about how close the parity is from the data. If it's too close, if the parity is too close to the data, then the related data items are also very close.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a chance of losing two of those guys at the same time.
Right.
If you lose two of those data items at the same time, you lost data.
Maybe we could do a head switch or something, store the parity.
Head switch.
Because usually the edges would be on one surface.
Oh, you mean a different platter?
Yes.
That would require you again to know which platter, which surface, and all that information. It's hard, I
mean. Yeah.
The low-level
information. Yeah, but that would be a good thing there, I guess.
Yeah.
No, but the thing about that is that you will incur in a complete rotational delay, the maximum.
For a back switch?
For a head switch.
Oh, sorry, for a head switch.
Yes.
Why?
Okay.